Access number 28672, Mr. Tony Bradbury, Reel 5. Now, we're talking about your time training as an electrics air fitter at Henlow from, I think it's March 44 to November.
Yes, that's right, yes.
We talked about some of the things you'd done, the theoretical lectures and the batteries and the DC-12-volt aircraft circuits and the bombing gear release circuits, but there was quite a lot in this course. I mean, it's a long course for that stage of the war.
I think it's about 32 weeks, the course. And in addition to theoretical work, we did quite a bit of practical work on aircraft. They were mainly old aircraft that were no longer serviceable, but they were in hangars, and we used to go and study the wiring. And we had one or two Barracudas there, but mainly Air Force planes, because it was an Air Force station. And we used to get instructed throughout by RAF personnel, who were very, very good, I must say.
Well, tell us a bit about the instructors. We're always interested. I mean, what were they like? How did they treat you?
Well, pretty good, because air fitters used to live on the main camp in Henlow, but the air mechanics, who were also under instruction on a shorter course, they used to have to march in every day and march back out every day from a camp about 2 miles outside the camp. And they seemed to be treated by the instructors as a rather inferior breed. And I think it rubbed off on us a bit, because we somehow got the impression they weren't as good as we were. But, of course, that's quite wrong, really, in retrospect. And
so what were the instructors like? Give us an idea.
Well, they were mainly corporals in the RAF, who instructed them at least one subject, and sometimes two. They used to ask us at times to give impromptu talks on various aspects of what we'd done. I remember my particular talk was on basics, because my particular experience before was in general engineering. And, of course, in those days, it was a bit cruder than it is now. We used to do such things as hardening and tempering of metals and all that sort of thing, and grinding up our own lathe tools and all that business. So I gave a talk to the class on that. But other people who were electricians before gave a talk on their particular aspect of electrical work. And I must say that the instructors were very tolerant of us. They were very well, they put up with a lot of cheek, really, as though we were in school, and we were a bit cheeky at times. But they seemed to let it go over. And they were very good to us all round, really. Much better than they were to the air mechanics, who one day, one night rather, protested against their treatment, because they came down one night and chopped down the flagpole in the main camp. It was the most impressive flagpole. And it was about 60, 70 feet high, and somehow or other they managed to chop it down. But when they found out the flagpole had been desecrated the following morning, all hell was to pay. They were trying to find the culprits. Of course, we had no idea that who it was, but they strongly suspected the air mechanics. And there was a lot of military police running around with revolvers and all that sort of thing, looking for the culprits. But in the end, everybody, air mechanics and air fitters all round, had to pay barrack room damages to cover the cost of the replacement, which I must say was a very much more modest flagpole than the one that had been chopped down. But that was the only sort of major confrontation between the RAF and the Navy on that particular site. we got instruction from officers, mainly naval officers, on various theoretical aspects of aircraft electrics and that sort of thing. And we also had talks from fairly ancient, as they were seen to be then, fairly ancient RAF officers on thermodynamics and the theory of flight, and general reminiscences of their experiences in the First World War. So that was really our course. At the end of the course, we took an exam. And
now, how difficult was it? Was it just a paper exam? Was it very much a practical?
As far as I remember, it was a paper exam. So we had an exam in all the various subjects that we covered. And when we passed out of the course, we were all then dispersed to other RAF stations all over the country to get practical experience of working on aircraft. And I must say that I had a good experience on Mustangs.
Now, where were you sent?
I was sent to RAF Rednal in... well, first of all, before going there, we went off to a holding camp down near Portsmouth. And there, I experienced the resumption of the air raids when we were at the camp. They raided Portsmouth, and they generally made life a bit uncomfortable for us.
What were the raids like? This would be what, November 44?
No, this would be later. This would be about... we'd had raids, first of all, in London. The Germans have resumed a modified sort of blitzkrieg in London while I was still at Fulham. And that continued. They resumed them again after I got to Bedhampton. That was the name of the camp, Bedhampton Camp, outside Portsmouth. I was there for about 3 weeks while we were all sent off to various...
So that would be sort of November, December time?
Around about that time,
so the
yes.
Raids were in December, probably. Then.
Yes, that sort of time.
What were the raids like? What do you remember of them?
Well, I don't remember much about them because I was a very heavy sleeper, and I managed to sleep through all the raids. And I'd wake up next morning, and my friends would say to me, "That was a bloody heavy raid last night." I said, "I didn't know there was one." They didn't believe me at first, and I realised I was a very heavy sleeper, and... frankly, I don't remember much about the raids, except when they came over fairly early in the evening, there'd be a lot of anti-aircraft fire and all that sort of thing. Then they'd go away and we'd all turn in. I'd go off to sleep, and sometimes they wouldn't come back, and sometimes they would. And when they did come back in the night, I never heard them. But the raids on the camp weren't anything to worry about, just the odd bomb round about the camp. But the raids on Portsmouth nearby, they were much more serious.
Were you sent to help clear up next day?
No, we never did any clearing up, except one time a German bomber got shot down. And we were sent out to look for the air crew because we thought the air crew had escaped. But we wandered all out through the woods and all the countryside round about Bedhampton and never saw any German aircraft crew. So we drew a blank there, I'm afraid. And very shortly after that...
Did you have any duties at all? I know it's a holding camp, but were you put any sort of fatigues or anything?
Yes, we did various odd jobs around the place. One of my jobs was to go around with a coal wagon and the coke wagon and top up the fuel for the various Nissen huts we lived in. I did that for a bit, and We did cookhouse duties, all that sort of thing. It's just general odd jobs to keep us going until we got drafted off to the RAF again.
Now, you were drafted to RAF Rednal?
Yes.
And when would that be?
That would
Christmas
be, I think, early 45, that would be.
So January, probably?
About January 45.
And this was just to the base, RAF Rednal?
RAF Rednal I went to, yes, with several other friends of mine. And some of them, in the same class, they went off to Montford Bridge, which is between Rednal and Shrewsbury. But we didn't see much of them after that, because the camp was about 15 miles away. But I got sent with a few others to Rednal. And the first thing I remember about going to Rednal was we arrived at the camp, and the station sergeant said to me, we've got a billet for you down the road. So I said, well, how far is that? He said, about 2 miles. So he said, you've got a choice here. He said, you can either walk in every morning and walk back again, or if you like, there's an old hut here with a load of bike parts in it. If you can make yourself up some sort of bike, you can ride in. So, anyway, he took me over to this hut, and it's full of old bicycle frames, wheels, old tyres, all that sort of thing. And somehow or other, I managed to concoct a bike out of this lot, and didn't have to walk in every morning. So, that was the mode of transport at Rednal.
What was your billet like?
And this is not again. We had all naval personnel in there, who most of them managed to make bikes for themselves again. But there was one chap I was friendly with, who was about 10 years older than I was. He'd never ridden a bike in his life. So first of all, I had to concoct him a bike, and then teach him how to ride it. So that was our method of transport. And after time, he got quite good. He was able to ride his bike into work. And we, on the very few off days we had, we'd go off riding around the countryside, looking for eggs and all that sort of thing, which we could get from the local farms. We could take home if we were to cook in the in the Nissen hut, that sort of thing. And we actually rode as far as the Wrekin one day, which is about 10 miles south of Shrewsbury. But by that time, my friend, Pallum Warner, as I used to call him, he was a bit fatigued, because we'd done about 50 miles that day, and he wasn't very much used to bike riding, you see. So we used to do trips around the area. We used to go to Llangollen, which was not very far away, about 10, 15 miles, that sort of thing. But our main expeditions with the bikes were to get eggs. And because we went in uniform, we had no civilian clothes, anything like that, we found the farmers very accommodating. They'd always sell us a dozen eggs for 3 bob a dozen. And so we live quite well on eggs, really, to supplement our rations.
Now, what duties were you doing? I mean, you were there to gain practical experience.
Yes.
What aircraft were you working on?
Well, the first thing I did, we got sent out, dispersed to various parts of the airfield, and the first job I did was to go into the aircraft instrument place. And the difference between the Navy and the RAF was that in the Navy, you had to do aircraft electrics and also instruments. You did the two things together. But in the Air Force, they had a separate instrument category and a separate electrical category. So I specialised, first of all, in artificial horizons, altimeters, all that sort of thing. Airspeed indicators, and I was there for about a month, And I must say, the man in charge of that was ever so helpful, very nice man. And he taught me a hell of a lot about aircraft instruments. Of course, they're nothing like they are today. They were much cruder than they are today, but they were all the going thing at the time. And I found the instructors very, very helpful. Well, after I'd done about a month there, I swapped over with somebody else. Somebody else went into that department. I went off to the hangars, and I found that all the things that I'd been taught at Henlow really didn't apply, because they taught us how to splice cables and all that sort of thing, but they hadn't taught us how to solder very much. And I found that in repairing of aircraft, soldering was a much more useful asset than splicing up old cables, although at times, if aircraft had to be turned around quickly, we had to splice cables. But generally speaking, when it came to repairing of the electrical work on aircraft, we had to solder, repair, that sort of thing. And there I learnt about...
Had you done any soldering before? I mean, it's quite a skill.
Oh, yes, I had done some, yes, which was a great help. In my work previously, I'd done soldering.
Well, not in the Navy. Well,
but not in the Navy. We never did any at Fulham, because that was all... The course there was mainly based on the old Aircraft Tester's course, which was filing, drilling holes, cutting threads, all that sort of thing. We had to be got proficient in that. And I must say that the rest of my time in the Navy, I never used any of those skills at all.
Now, which aircraft were you working on? Was there a
mainly Mustangs. The head Mustangs there.
Now, tell me a bit about the electrics of the Mustang, or the sort of problems that would arise.
Well, they'd sometimes the navigation lights would become disconnected, and we'd have to go out and repair those. Other times, there'd be somebody would tread carelessly and damage a cable, and we'd have to rerun a cable wherever possible. And if not, we'd have to splice it, but we'd not very often. But mainly our work was to do what they call daily inspections on the Mustangs, which involved the instruments and the electrical control gear as well.
Now tell me about that. What would a typical daily inspection be like? What would you cover?
Well, first of all, we'd check the batteries, and we'd make sure that they were well topped up, they weren't leaking, and that they were sufficiently well charged up to do another trip, as it was called. Because I found that far from the strict routine we've been taught at Henlow, that the attitude at Rednall generally was, if it's all right, it'll do another trip. Because really, I think that attitude was engendered by the fact they hadn't got a lot of time. It's all right to say these things in the classroom, but when you come round to the actual work on an aircraft, if an aircraft is required quickly, you do your best for it, or declare it unserviceable, US as it was called. So what we had to do was to go round and first of all check the batteries, make sure they were all right. Then we'd go round and check the wiring.
How?
Yeah, the L side.
Sorry? How would you check the wiring?
Oh, well, we'd just go round and look at it as much as we could, see if it was all right. Just see if it was not damaged or anything like this.
So a visual inspection, not an electrical check.
No, a visual check, really. And then we'd check all the apparatus to make sure it's still in working order. We'd check the navigation lights, of course, that's important. We'd have to check from the instrument point of view, we'd have to check the pitot head, blow up the pitot head to make sure that the airspeed indicator was working, that sort of thing. We'd actually have to blow up the head, cover the static vents, as they were called, and blew up the active vent to make sure that the airspeed indicator was working. Do a visual check of the cockpit of the artificial horizon, the airspeed indicator, all those other bits that the pilot used, the altimeter, all that sort of thing. We have to make sure that the altimeter setting was right for the particular barometric pressure of the day. We have to set that on for the particular station. We have to get that in the morning. Set the barometric pressure on the altimeter so that he was quite sure that he could check against his height, as indicated by the height indicator, that he was also getting the right barometric pressure, which, if it changed rapidly while he was in flight, would be indicated to him by the air traffic controllers. But we used to start off by putting the correct barometric pressure on in the morning, which we'd get from the ATC as well. And those are the sort of checks we have to do. Generally, look at the electrical control gear, make sure that the voltage controller wasn't damaged, that sort of thing. And then be reasonably happy that the aircraft was fit to fly again on a daily basis.
Now, would this check be done by just one person, or would there be a couple of you on it?
No, there'd be the airframes people, they do their side. The engine people would do their side, but we didn't have any engine or airframe fitters with us on at Rednall. But all we used to do was learn how to do daily inspections. And after we'd been doing those for a bit, we'd get examined to make sure that we knew how to do them. We then got passed on to the repair shops, which did weekly inspections, which were more elaborate.
What were they like then?
Well, a stricter version of the daily inspections, really. The aircraft would be taken out of service, put into the hangar, and we'd have to look at all the various bits that we were concerned with in greater detail. So we'd do all that, and then we'd get examined again to make sure we knew what weekly inspections involved. And then on a periodic basis, they'd be brought in, they'd have for their quarterly inspections, in which case they'd be gone over pretty thoroughly, mainly by the airframes and engines people, who we used to work in with anyway, and they'd show us what they were doing, but we never used to actually do it ourselves. I must say that all the RAF personnel that worked on the aircraft were very, very helpful. And again, we gradually worked in with them and got less cheeky. And we became very good friends, really.
So it all sort of evened out? It all evened out?
It all evened out, yes. They were a bit... we were the first lot to arrive at Rednall, so they were a bit wary of us to begin with.
What was your rank at this stage? I'm not quite...
I was an airfitter. Airfitter L, as it was called. I used to have airfitter E, which was for engines, A for airframes, L for electrics and instruments, and O for ordnance. So they had those four different categories. And previously, we'd been selected for these different categories at Henlow, and I say selected, they selected us, we didn't select our categories, because of my previous experience, I wanted to become an airframes fitter, but no, you've got to become an electrical fitter, so I became an electrical fitter, and that was it.
Now, anything else you were doing at Rednall?
Well, apart from the work on aircraft, which, as I say, we gradually progressed in that. We did the various progressions, daily, weekly, quarterly inspections, all that sort of thing. When we got to quarterly inspections...
What were they like then?
Well, we used to help. They wouldn't let us sign for those because we hadn't got enough experience. So we used to help on those, and we used to go round with the actual electrical and instrument people. We used to take out the blind flying panel, as it's called, or the big panel in the cockpit that had all the instruments on. That would all be taken down. All the instruments would be removed and marked up from which aircraft they came from. They would then go off to the various departments. In our case, the instrument department at the camp. All the instruments would be checked, and when they'd been checked, they'd be sent back to the hangar, and we'd reassemble the whole lot. But the RAF people didn't think we had sufficient experience to sign off the quarterly inspections, so we'd help out by assembling all the panels, all that sort of thing, and then perhaps a corporal or a sergeant would come and check them, and then we'd be allowed to put them back into the aircraft and connect up all the necessary gear to them. That would be checked again, and then he would sign, he or she in some cases would sign for the completed work. And that's how life went on at Rednal.
Now, how long were you there for?
Not very long, because they decided, I think about May 45, they decided to close the camp.
Now, is this before or after VE Day?
Just after. We were there for VE Day.
What do you remember of that? Was there any sort of celebration?
Well, we got let off for a couple of days, and we spent time cycling around the area. I was friendly with a WAF, and so were several of our people, and we used to make up parties and cycle around the camp or go round to Llangollen. And I remember on VE Day, I went to Llangollen with this party of people, and we had quite a jolly time at Llangollen, and that was our celebrations there. Sometimes we went to Oswestry, which was a town not very far away.
How did you feel about VE Day? I mean, were you pleased that the war in Europe was over?
Yeah.
Were you very aware that the Japanese war was still going on?
Oh, I was very much aware of the Japanese war still going on, which I'll come to that in a minute. But we had quite a reasonable time at Rednal, but shortly after VE Day, they decided to close the camp and move it to Melksham. In Wiltshire.
Melksham, how do you spell that through?
M-E-L-K-S-H-A-M, RAF Melksham we went to. So the whole camp got on a train at near Rednal. Oh, by the way, we'd had quite a good pub life in Rednal. And several times we used to cycle out to pubs in the evening, that sort of thing. There was one place I particularly remember called Royton of the Eleven Towns, which was about 4 or 5 miles away. And we got very well treated by the locals there. And I remember one of the owners of the pub there had also a small farm. And he was a bit worried about... getting in his hay. This was a little while after VE Day. He was a bit worried about getting in his hay, so a crowd of us said, "We'll get your hay in." And we all got onto his field, gathered in the hay, and he was so chuffed with this that he provided us with unlimited beer free of charge, which was very welcome. And then we went off to one of the local houses where the local people were also celebrating the end of the war and got very well treated there. And in a way, I was very sorry to leave because I made a lot of friends at Rednal, both in the Air Force and people living outside.
And you moved to Melsham when? Just May?
Getting on towards the end of May.